Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bible 241, and it is September 13th. We got our second lecture on chapter 6, interactions between cells and their environment. So we'll finish that up today, maybe move on to the next chapter, depending maybe on questions and things like that. And then next week, we're going to cover chapter 3, cell structure, genetic control, and then we have our first exam coming up. So you should be well prepared. Already should be doing a lot of these exercises in Blackboard and reading the chapter and working the practice questions in Blackboard. And there are a lot of questions in Blackboard to review. And some of those questions that I put on the exam, but you can't just memorize the answers to them because there are just too many questions. So you got to have a pretty good understanding of what the question is trying to get at and how you get to the correct answer. All right, so please don't try to just memorize the answers to the questions that are online. You have to develop an understanding. Let's see, what else is happening? Oh, I got your lectures online for the first 2 weeks, and then pretty soon I'll put the lectures from this week online so that you can listen to them. And that's all that I can remember. Okay, so that's the schedule. So 1 week from Monday coming up is your first exam. And I did have some questions about what chapters are on the exam. It's 1, 2, 3, and 6. 1, 2, 3, and 6. 1, 2, 3, and 6. Okay. Any questions on the schedule like that? Nope. Okay. Last time we were talking about active transport. What the heck is active transport again? When something goes from low concentration to high concentration, that's active transport. And now you know a couple forms of active transport. What are two general forms of active transport? Primary active transport and secondary. What's the energy source for primary active transport? ATP. What's the energy source for secondary active transport? It's going to be a gradient of some a concentration gradient of some chemical, maybe a sodium concentration gradient, or it could be potassium, but some kind of concentration gradient. All right, then we started talking about equilibrium potential, and equilibrium potential, the potential just means that, I got to find my cursor. Ah, here it is. Okay, equilibrium potential, remember potential means voltage. Means it's potential energy, not kinetic energy. It's the ability to do work. And there is a difference in electrical charge across the membrane. So when there's a difference in electrical charge, we call that a voltage or a potential. And in all living cells, a good benchmark is about minus 90 millivolts. So the inside of the cell is negative compared to the outside. And we said that we can use an equation called the Nernst equation to calculate what the equilibrium potential is for one ion at a time. Even though your body has numerous ions in solution, there's that one equation where we can forget about all the others and just calculate it according to one ion. There, that's maybe a little bit better. And it's developed because inside the cell there are a lot of negative charges. Right? So that's going to draw positive charges inside the cell, more so that there's going to be an unequal concentration across the membrane. If there are no ions, anions inside the cell, then if we were to let potassium diffuse into the cell, there would be equal concentrations. But because we have all these negative charges, that draws even a few more positive charges inside the cell. So we have a higher concentration of potassium inside than outside, and at equilibrium, okay, these forces are exactly balanced and opposite each other. So the electrical attraction is drawing potassium in, but as you get a higher concentration of potassium inside the cell, what does it like to do? It likes to move out down its concentration gradient. And so these two forces at equilibrium balance each other out, and you still have excess potassium inside the cell, but you also still have an excess amount of negative electrical charge as well. And that's why we have a battery. Every cell acts like a battery. So here is an equation that you're going to have to learn how to use for to answer some questions at the end of the chapter and also on the test coming up. All right. It gives you the membrane voltage needed to counteract the concentration forces acting on this particular ion. All right, so you have the electrical charge that's drawing potassium in, but you have a concentration gradient that's trying to force it out. Right, and this is the electrical voltage that balances out that that force, the concentration force that's trying to put potassium out of the cell. And so that's what happens at equilibrium. So here is the Nernst equation. So the equilibrium potential of some ion, X, and we just got done talking about what ion? What would you want to put right here? Potassium, yeah, you'd want to put potassium right here. Is going to be equal to 61 divided by the valence charge. And does anybody know what the charge of a potassium is? Yeah, and is it minus 1 or plus 1? Yeah, so you got to be really careful. So you got to put plus 1 in here, and if it's an ion that's an anion, you'd have to put minus 1 in for Z. Okay, and then take the log of the concentration across the membrane. Would you have the concentration on the outside divided by the inside? Do this division, then take the log of it, and then multiply by this number right here to figure out what the voltage is. All right, so that takes us to this slide. So here we have a typical kind of cell, and we've got four ions that are important in our body. We've got sodium, potassium, chloride, and what's Ca? Calcium, yeah, calcium. Okay. All right, what's the valence on sodium? Okay, I want you to be just a little bit more specific, because I'm not quite sure if everybody sees that. It's what? Plus one. What's the valence of potassium? Plus one. What's the valence on chloride? Minus one. And what about calcium? Plus two. Yeah, now you know this is Z that goes into this part of the equation right here. And then you get the other numbers by looking at the concentrations of sodium and these other electrolytes across the membrane. So this is the inside of the cell. Okay, 12 millimolar for sodium, it's 145 on the outside. All right, I don't want you to memorize these numbers, okay, but you should have a feel for where is sodium at a high concentration in a normal living cell? Outside, and this confirms that. Where is potassium going to be a high concentration? Inside the cell. Here's something else that's pretty important, and that is this chloride ion. Where is it at a high concentration, or is it equal across the cell membrane? It's higher outside the cell. And another very important one is calcium. Where is it high? Outside the cell by a lot. It's almost zero inside the cell under most circumstances. Okay, so it's probably a good idea for you to get an understanding of where it's high, where it's low. You don't have to memorize the numbers, but you do have to know where to get these numbers to plug into the Nernst equation right here to figure out what the equilibrium potential is. Okay, and this Nernst equation will only work for one ion at a time, okay, not for all of them together, and then we can't even add all of those four answers together to figure out what the overall potential across the cell membrane is, right, but we can just understand it in terms of each of these ions right here. Okay, so calculate the equilibrium potential for potassium. What would we do? For Z, we would put in plus one, right, and the concentration outside, what number would we put right here for potassium? 5, right? And then inside is 150. So 5 divided by 150, take the log of it, multiply it by 61, then divide it by 1. Of course, you don't have to really do that. Then you would get the equilibrium potential in millivolts. Okay, so that's what this 61 is all about, just to make sure that the units match up between concentration and millivolts, and not volts or megavolts or anything like that. All right, so you could calculate the same thing for sodium, but you'd use different numbers. For the outside, you'd put 145. The inside, you'd put 12. And Z would still be the same, would be plus 1. Okay, so make sure you know how to punch those numbers in your calculator. And you know where your log button is. All right, so here are some of the answers right here. I think this one is close. I can't remember if I corrected the slide or not. It might be 61 or 62. Somebody maybe could check that if you get your calculator out right now, okay, to see if I corrected the slide. Minus 90 is correct, but you should be able to calculate it for chloride as well as calcium. It's 66? Wow, 66. It's off by a lot. Okay, so plus 60. Is it minus 66 or plus 66? Plus. Okay. All right, so notice that the magnitude of the voltage is opposite for potassium and sodium, okay, even though they're both cations, and that's because they're at a high concentration on opposite sides of the cell, so they will have a different equilibrium potential because of that. Okay, so that should make sense. All right, so that equilibrium potential contributes to that battery nature of the cell that we call the resting membrane potential or resting membrane voltage. And I'm just going to call it RMP for right now and for the rest of the class. All right, so RMP is the membrane voltage of a cell when it's not producing something that we call action potentials or when an action potential is in motion along a cell. All right, so when the cell is at rest, that's just the voltage. RMP in most cells is minus 65 to minus 85, so minus 70 is a pretty good ballpark figure. It's kind of right smack in the middle. There's some variation between different kinds of tissues, but every living cell has an RMP. All right, RMP depends on the concentrations of ions inside and outside the cell, and you can calculate that using the Nernst equation, but there's some other very important things that contribute to RMP. And one probably even more important thing, which we barely deal with in this class in a quantitative way, is the permeability of an ion through the membrane. All right, so if an ion can actually move through the membrane, then the RMP changes pretty drastically. All right, so we can calculate it using the Nernst equation. There are equations that you can use to calculate the membrane potential considering all of the ions and then the permeability, but that's kind of beyond the level of this class. Maybe in another class you looked at this equation. It's called the Goldman equation, but we don't have to pay much attention to it. All right, so the ion that affects the resting membrane potential the most is potassium because it's the most permeable even under resting conditions. So permeability has a big influence on resting membrane potential. Some sodium diffuses in, so RMP is less negative than the equilibrium potential for potassium. All right, so when a cell is at rest, the inside of the membrane is negative, the outside is relatively positive, and so you can measure that with a voltmeter. All right, so why does sodium diffuse inside the cell? We want to analyze that. Why, under resting conditions, why does sodium have a tendency to enter the cell? What can you tell me about the inside of the cell right here? It's more negative, and sodium is a cation, so there is an electrical attraction. Sodium wants to enter the cell, right, to neutralize those negative charges. But what else can you tell me about sodium? It's high outside, it's low inside. So there's a second driving force for sodium to enter the cell, and that's the concentration gradient. All right, so I think that's pretty important for you to realize that there are two forces right here. One is the electrical force, and the other is the concentration force. And at rest, sodium likes to enter the cell for both reasons, to neutralize the electrical charge, but also to equalize the concentration gradient across the membrane. So I think there's a couple of questions where you have to actually analyze that thing. Okay, membrane potential is also influenced by the sodium potassium ATP pump because it pumps two potassiums into the cell for every three sodiums that leave the cell. So because there's an unequal electrical charge whenever this pump works right here, that makes the outside a little bit more positive, which means that the inside becomes a little bit more negative. It's the same way of thinking of this, of that concept. And that adds about minus 3 millivolts to RMP. All right, so that influences resting membrane potential. This slide right here shows all of the things that we've talked about so far and how the resting membrane potential is developed. Well, first there are fixed anions inside the cell. So there are what kind of charges trapped inside the cell that can't get out? Negative charges, right? That's an anion. All right, then there are unequal permeabilities of the plasma membrane to these ions. Potassium is more permeable, sodium is less permeable. That adds to the resting membrane potential. All right, and then we have the concentration gradient. And we can use the Nernst equation to figure out what the membrane potential is at equilibrium. Okay, so it's sodium higher on the outside, potassium higher on the inside. And that's partially due to the sodium-potassium pump that leads to an uneven distribution of ions across the membrane. Okay, and here are the voltages. Oh, here. 66. That's just what you said. Really good. Trust your calculator. Okay. All right, so That all then contributes to the resting membrane potential of minus 70 millivolts. All right, so we just can't look at the equilibrium potential for sodium and potassium and add them together to get RMP, because there are other things that influence what the resting membrane potential is. And probably the most important thing right here is permeability. We're not dealing with that in a nice quantitative fashion, but in a qualitative fashion through the rest of the class, we will. All right, so that's it for resting membrane potential and why a cell acts like a battery. Okay, now let's look at this cell right here. All right, let's just say this is a nice living cell, and we put a voltmeter across the cell membrane, and we measure minus 70 millivolts. All right, but what if we take another cell and put a voltmeter across the cell membrane, and we actually measure 0 volts? What can you tell me about that cell? And it's going to be similar to if I were to give you a battery and you were to measure the voltage across the battery terminals and it read 0, what could you tell me about that battery? It's dead, right? It's not going to power anything. You could put it in your cell phone, but your cell phone's not going to turn on, right, because the battery's dead. All right, now let's go to the cell. If we put this voltmeter across the cell and we see 0 volts right here, what can you tell me about that cell? It's dead as well. Okay, so just like a dead battery, if a cell does not have that voltage, its internal machinery is not working, and it's a dead cell as a result of it. Okay, so that's a pretty important kind of concept. All right, let's change the topic maybe just a little bit and talk about cell signaling. How do cells in your body coordinate each other and contribute to homeostasis? So here's a pretty important concept. The structural and functional unit of communication between cells is the synapse. All right, so I want you to know a lot about a synapse. So I want you to know the structure of a synapse and why it functions the way it does. How does it transmit information? Is it bidirectional or unidirectional? And what does it use? Okay, in anatomy, I use this concept a lot as a theme. Let's see, what did we use in anatomy as a structural and functional unit? Of those of you that had anatomy with you, what's a structural and functional unit of contraction? Anybody remember structural and functional unit of contraction from anatomy? It's the sarcomere. The sarcomere. And in anatomy, we said there's life has a structural and functional unit. What's the structural and functional unit of life? A cell. Yeah, so if you know all the structures of a cell and how they function, then you have a pretty good idea of what life is all about. If you know all the structures that make up a sarcomere and how those structures function, then you really know how muscle contracts. All right, so I do want you to know all the structural features of a synapse, and that will help you understand what the function of a synapse is. Okay, there are two general types of synapses that we find in the body. There are some that are electrical, and there are some that are chemical. As a matter of fact, there's very few that are electrical. Most are chemical. So some cells signal each other with some electrical information. Others use a chemical signal in order to transmit information. All right, so let's talk about electrical synapses first. So here we see one cell. I see a nice membrane right here, phospholipid bilayer. And then down below it, there's another cell. And typically, sodium can't move across the cell membrane because sodium is a polar compound. It has an electrical charge. And the interior of this membrane right here is nonpolar, so sodium cannot really diffuse across the cell unless there is a channel or a pore or some kind of protein that allows sodium to move. All right, so this is a cell membrane, is a permeability barrier to sodium. Okay, then under resting conditions, what is the inside of the cell compared to the outside in terms of RMP? The inside is negative. Yeah, the inside is negative, the outside is positive because there's a lot of sodium on the outside of the cell. All right, so what is sodium dying to do? It's trying to rush inside the cell to neutralize both the electric charge and the concentration gradient, okay? And when sodium enters the cell, that's an excitatory signal. It neutralizes the electrical potential. And so usually we explain cell excitation as sodium entering the cell. So this cell gets excited when sodium enters. All right, so now we have a high concentration of sodium inside this cell because it's been excited. And here is a nice modification of the cell membrane between these neighboring cells. This is what we call a gap junction. All right, so now this cell on the top has become more positive on the inside, okay, and it has more sodium compared to the one that's on the bottom. The one on the bottom is still nice and negative on the inside, has very low sodium. So guess what happens to the sodium that's in the top cell? It wants to get into the bottom cell, and because these two cells have this special gap junction, sodium can flow through this gap junction right here, and when it does, guess what it does to the bottom cell? Just like it did to the top cell, we said when sodium enters, we consider that excitation. So then this neighboring cell becomes excited as well. All right, so excitation due to these sodium currents can happen from one cell to another by diffusion of sodium through these gap junctions right here. But it's really an electrical synapse, because when sodium is moving, it's changing the electrical properties of these cells. So a gap junction is a great example of an electrical synapse. So mostly where we find gap junctions is not in nervous tissue, but for sure within the myocardium. Right? All we have to do is excite one cell within the myocardium. And when I say myocardium, what organ am I thinking about? The heart. Yeah, the heart. Myocardium and heart is the same thing. Right? Only one heart cell has to become excited electrically, and because there's gap junctions between all the cells in the heart that make up the myocardium, all the cells of the myocardium become excited, and then what does the heart do? It contracts as a unit, right? So one part of the heart doesn't contract, and then another, and another, and another, because that wouldn't pump blood. The whole heart has to contract as a unit, and when the whole heart contracts, then blood is ejected into the great vessels coming off the base of the heart. So cardiac muscle has gap junctions. There are some in the central nervous system, right? But it's not a common feature. Gap junctions are not found in other kinds of muscle, like skeletal muscle. Where does skeletal muscle attach itself to? Skeletal muscle attaches to your skeleton. Yeah, to your skeleton. That's why we call it skeletal muscle. And when skeletal muscle contracts, it moves your skeleton around. All right? And skeletal muscle does not have gap junctions. And that's a really nice feature. I'm glad my skeletal muscle doesn't have gap junctions, because what would happen to your skeleton if you were to contract one muscle cell in your body someplace if they had gap junctions? Well, then all your muscles would contract, right? You'd reach to get a glass of water and your whole body would contract. That would not be good, okay? So electrical synapses are not used to control skeletal muscles, but chemical synapses are, so because it can be very specific. All right, so here's an example of an electrical synapse. And let's talk about another scheme using a chemical signal. All right, so on this slide right here, we have a tissue, and it's just a simple layer right here, that is going to synthesize and secrete a signaling compound. And this is what we call a paracrine agent. A paracrine agent gets secreted into the interstitial space, and then it moves by diffusion, which is high concentration by the cell that secreted it, to a lower concentration to some cell within the neighborhood. All right, so it's going to go from high concentration to low. That's the moving force. All right, so here are the secretory cells, and these cells will want to control, for instance, these target tissue cells. And this is a target tissue. It can respond to this signaling compound if it has a special feature on the cell membrane, and maybe sometimes on the inside of the cell, but usually on the cell membrane, and that's called a receptor. So this tissue right here can respond to the signaling compound if it has a receptor. If it has a receptor to this signaling compound, then we can call it a target tissue. All right, but only target tissues will have a receptor. And once they have a receptor, it will bind this ligand. So a ligand will bind to a receptor, and it will change the physiology of this cell somehow. Okay, but maybe increasing the activity of an enzyme, or opening an enzyme, an ion channel, or something like that, but there has to be a receptor. So we always explain binding of a ligand to a receptor by what kind of feature? What kind of like explanation? Okay, it's by shape. So here we see a nice spherical molecule, right? Will this spherical molecule bind to a receptor that has the shape of a triangle? Not very well, okay? Or this shape of a square. Not very well. The shape of the receptor has to be circular in order to bind to it. But please remember that biological compounds are not just simple circles or squares or triangles. They're very complicated three-dimensional structures, so receptors can have a very complicated structure as well. And if a ligand can bind to a receptor, then that describes the specificity of that reaction, right? The shape has to be very specific. All right, so what must a target cell contain in order to respond to a signal molecule? A receptor. What must be the shape of the binding site of the paracrine receptor? It's got to be, what, complementary to the shape of the signaling molecule. So, for instance, if the signaling molecule is square, then the receptor has to be square. If it's triangular, then the receptor has to be triangular. Or if it's triangular, circular, square, 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 triangular, then the receptor has to be what? Whatever I said. Okay? Okay. All right, so it's by shape. All right, another kind of scheme. Here is an example of a neuron and a skeletal muscle cell. You know this is skeletal muscle because it's nice and linear. I see striations. I see some sarcomeres in there. All right, the job of an axon is to pass electrical information from the dendrite over the cell body down this long axon to the axon terminus, and there the electrical signal stops. All right, so at rest, there is a voltage across the membrane that we call RMP. Okay, and when this cell gets excited, sodium rushes in, and that changes the nature of the cell, and it sends something that we're going to see as an action potential down this axon right here. So the electrical signal reaches the end of the axon, and when that electrical signal reaches the end of the axon, it causes release of a signaling compound. All right, so that electrical signal can't hop across this junction between the nerve cell and the muscle cell, okay, because that would be like a lightning bolt. And we don't have lightning bolts running things inside our body. Okay? We don't have that necessary voltage to do that. So evolution has figured out another way to do that, and that is to pass the signal as a chemical signal from the neuron to the target tissue right here, which is a skeletal muscle. So you have an electrical signal. It's converted into a chemical signal. The chemical signal diffuses across the synapse. And then that chemical signal binds to a receptor on the muscle cell, which then creates another electrical signal that flows over the whole muscle cell. Okay, so you got a chemical signal, an electrical signal in the neuron, then a chemical signal, and then it's converted back into an electrical signal. So you got electrical, chemical, electrical. And since a chemical is being used to signal this muscle cell right here, we call that a chemical synapse. Right, and the particular name of that chemical signal from a neuron right here is called a neurotransmitter, because the neuron transmits this signal across the synapse to the muscle, so we call it a neurotransmitter. Okay, and you're going to have to know some names of some specific kinds of neurotransmitters. If it is a muscle cell, every single case, right, there's only one neurotransmitter that works, and that's called acetylcholine. Or ACH is the neurotransmitter. Other examples of neurotransmitters in the body would be norepinephrine, epinephrine, serotonin, and we're going to talk about some of these other kinds of neurotransmitters in different parts of the nervous system. All right, so this is the usual kind of synapse. This is a chemical synapse. So the signal changes from an electrical to chemical, then back to an electrical signal again in a chemical synapse. All right, what must be the shape of the binding site of the neurotransmitter receptor that's on this muscle cell right here? It's got to be complementary in shape, right? So if the shape of the neurotransmitter is circular, triangular, square, then the receptor has to have a complementary shape that's circular, triangular, square. Otherwise, this neurotransmitter can't bind to it. And if it can't bind, then the muscle cell won't become excited when that happens. So you can think of hand and glove kind of model or lock and key model to understand the relationship between a ligand, in this particular case a neurotransmitter, and the receptor. A ligand is some small molecule that binds to a receptor. Okay, here's another form of cell signaling in the endocrine system. Here we have a gland that is producing a product. And when the gland secretes this product, it just goes into the interstitial space. And then it moves by a concentration gradient into this capillary right here. And once it's in the capillary, it's in the blood. Where does it go? Everywhere that blood goes. Everywhere in your whole body. Okay, so here's a signaling compound that's being transmitted everywhere in your body. and then it's going to get to a distant part of your body that has very low concentration of the signaling compound in the extracellular space. So it's going to diffuse out of a capillary into this space, and it's going to diffuse around, and it might influence these cells right here. But what do these cells have to have in order to be influenced by this signaling compound? They have to have a receptor. If these cells have a receptor, then they are a target tissue. If they don't have a receptor, then they're going to completely ignore this signaling compound, and they're not a target tissue. All right, so this kind of gland is what we call an endocrine gland, not an exocrine gland, because an endocrine gland is a ductless gland. It does not use a duct to transmit its product to other parts of the body. What an endocrine gland does, it uses the cardiovascular system. All right, so an endocrine gland is ductless. It secretes a signaling compound that we call a hormone. That hormone gets into the blood, and it can have an effect on a distant target tissue because those distant target tissues have a receptor. All right, so this is an endocrine-type signaling scheme. What must be the shape of the binding site of the hormone receptor? Complementary in shape, right? Just like for the other kinds of synapses. Okay, so let's consider a couple different kinds of regulatory molecules. And I think a good place to start is by understanding the nature, the physical chemistry of a cell membrane, once again. Remember, on the outside, these are phosphate groups that are highly polar. There's charges on them, so they want to associate with water. That's why they're facing the extracellular water. And on the inside of the membrane, you have that phosphate group again, which is very polar, so it wants to be facing in toward the aqueous environment inside the cell. And then in the middle of the membrane right here, you have lipid world, right? You just have you have fatty acids. You have this nonpolar region where water necessarily can't get through, sodium and potassium can't get through because these are all polar compounds. All right, so a nonpolar or a hydrophobic regulatory molecule is nonpolar. It doesn't really like to dissolve in water. It likes to dissolve in lipid environment, right? So a nonpolar regulatory molecule can actually pass right through the cell membrane because this is not a permeability barrier to it. It can exist within this lipid layer very easily. And so it then will bind to a receptor that's inside the cell. All right, so hydrophobic regulatory molecules have intracellular receptors just because of the physical chemistry. These receptors right here will combine in different ways we're going to look at, which then are going to affect the nucleus, and it's going to then cause protein synthesis to begin by a couple of processes. The first step is transcription. The second step is translation. I think we're going to look at that in the next chapter. So if those are kind of mysterious terms, we're going to look at those in chapter 3. All right, so when you have a nonpolar signaling compound like steroids, because what class of compound is a steroid? It's a lipid, right? So it can diffuse through the cell membrane right here. Thyroid hormones and then nitric oxide can diffuse through the cell membrane. The cell has receptors for them, but they are cytoplasmic receptors. And most of these work by changing some biochemistry of the nucleus by initiating protein synthesis. All right, so when a receptor binds, when a cytoplasmic receptor binds a signaling molecule, before the cell can respond or produces a response, right, it takes a long time for that to happen because protein synthesis has to begin, and there's two steps for protein synthesis, transcription and translation. So this is a relatively slow process. Okay, so that's one other distinction probably you should be aware of. If it's a hydrophilic regulatory molecule, one that likes to dissolve in water, right, if we consider the physical chemistry of the cell membrane right here, right, it can't get through this lipid region. So it's trapped outside the cell. So if you have a molecule that's trapped outside the cell, how on earth does it change the physiology of something inside the cell? Okay, that's what we want to be concerned with. A lot of people won some pretty cool Nobel Prizes for this. Okay, so let's see what they found. So here's this signaling molecule, can't get inside the cell. But this cell has a receptor, not in the cytoplasm, but on the cell surface. So the regulatory molecule doesn't have to get inside the cell to bind to receptor. It's on the outside of the cell. So it binds to this cell membrane receptor, And when it binds, it causes the development of a second messenger, a second compound then begins to build up inside the cell, which is different than the signaling molecule. We're going to look at some of these throughout the whole class. All right, so the messenger that is outside of the cell, trapped outside the cell, is what we call the first messenger. And why is it trapped outside the cell? Because it's soluble in water, not lipid, not the internal environment of the cell membrane right here. So the first messenger is always outside the cell. It binds to a protein right here that produces a second messenger inside the cell, and now you get the message inside the cell, and that's going to change the physiology of the cell on the inside. So this concept right here we call signal transduction, right? Because it's being transduced across the membrane. You get a first messenger outside the cell, and where do you always find a second messenger? Inside the cell. And when a first messenger causes the second messenger to develop inside the cell, what do we call that process? Signal transduction, moving across the cell membrane. Okay, so you got to have a membrane receptor and then some other kind of mechanism right here. All right, so activated receptors send second messengers into the cytoplasm to mediate the actions of the regulatory molecule. So you never find a first messenger inside the cell. That's all I want to say. I don't want to say something about the second messenger outside, because sometimes the second messenger is outside the cell and it enters. So I don't want to say anything about that. Where our first messenger is always located? Outside. Where are second messengers? Inside the cell. That's a pretty good concept. All right, so this is for a hydrophilic kind of compound that cannot enter the cell. But if it is hydrophobic, that compound can enter the cell, so the receptor is intracellular or cytoplasmic. If it is a hydrophilic regulatory molecule, cannot enter the cell, so the receptor has to be on the outside. All right, here's a list of some second messengers that are pretty important that we're going to look at. Some of them are ions, and a perfect example would be calcium. All right, where is calcium usually at a low concentration? Okay, it's at a low concentration, I mentioned almost zero inside the cell. So under normal circumstances, if calcium is a second messenger, it's not having an effect on the cell under normal circumstances. It's only when a first messenger binds to this receptor and then calcium enters the cell as a result. Because where is calcium at a high concentration? Outside the cell. So calcium is trying to rush in, but it can only under certain circumstances. So calcium is a good example. Another compound that's used as a second messenger is something called cyclic AMP. And cyclic AMP forms a ring. AMP is a kind of a form of ATP. How many phosphates does ATP have on it? It has three, adenosine triphosphate. And adenosine monophosphate has only one. So if you take an ATP and chop off two phosphates, you get an AMP molecule, and if it's done with a certain kind of enzyme that makes a nice ring structure, we call that cyclic AMP. It's kind of a special structure that could be used as a second messenger inside the cell. All right, so if you have just a regular linear AMP versus a cyclic AMP, can you see that your cells can identify that as being two different compounds? Because what's different about them? The shape is radically different, right? Okay, even though they have the same amount of atoms, right, but the arrangement and position is different. Then there are G proteins. This is the most common kind of signal transduction scheme in our bodies. Okay, and then also diacyl glycerate, but we can just call that DAG in here. If DAG builds up inside the cell, that can change the physiology of the internal environment of the cell. And also inositol 3-phosphate, and we can just call that IP3 for fun. Okay, these can be, all of these can be second messengers. So where are you going to find these things if they're going to be signaling compounds inside the cell? And normally they're going to be at a low concentration inside the cell. They only begin to develop and become a high concentration inside the cell if what is present outside the cell? The first messenger, right, binding to a receptor someplace. Okay, so G proteins. Since this is a real important class of signal transduction pathways, let's spend a little bit of time generally looking at a G protein And then through the rest of the class, we're going to look at some specific examples. All right, so G proteins are part of a second messenger pathway in many cells. All right, so the G protein is a second messenger. What kind of signaling compound, okay, will they be working with? They're going to be working with a first messenger, but what can you tell me about the physical chemistry of that first messenger? Is it hydrophilic or hydrophobic? Okay, it's going to be hydrophilic, which means it can't get across the cell membrane, right? So there's got to be some kind of signal transduction scheme. And G proteins are one of these schemes. All right, a G protein contains three subunits. And normally, when the cell is not excited, these three subunits are bound together. And when the surface receptor is bound to its ligand, then these subunits can break apart. All right, so, and then the subunits can float around on the inside of the cell membrane. And when they float around inside the cell membrane, they can bind to an ion channel. This is going to be an effector. And when it bumps into the ion channel, sometimes it will open up the ion channel. And if it's an ion channel for sodium, what's sodium going to do? It's going to rush inside the cell. For what reasons? Because the cell is negative, number one, but also because sodium is at a low concentration inside the cell. So the electrochemical gradient is drawing sodium inside the cell, both of those gradients. Okay? Or maybe the subunit will bind to an enzyme turning on a metabolic pathway. Maybe it's going to turn on an enzyme that's going to grab an ATP and make a cyclic AMP out of it by chopping off two phosphates. All right, and that will be an effector as well. And then cyclic AMP becomes what inside the cell? So if the first messenger binds to a G protein, the G protein dissociates, will bump into an enzyme that will then convert ATP into cyclic AMP inside the cell. All right, then what do we call that cyclic AMP inside the cell? That's what we're going to call it, a second messenger inside the cell. And again, that only happens for a hydrophilic kind of molecule because it's got to be a receptor on the outside of the cell. Okay, so this enzyme or this ion channel can change the activity of the cell on the inside. All right, so here is a nice illustration of what we just talked about. This is going to be easier to understand, I think, once you see an illustration of it. So here we see a cell membrane. Here's the extracellular space. This is outside the cell. And then this is the inside of the cell right here. Nice phospholipid bilayer, but it's been modified by a receptor. And the receptor is coupled to this G protein. How many subunits did we say a G protein has? It's got three. And we're just going to call them 1, 2, 3, but people don't usually do that. They call it alpha, beta, and gamma. Okay. Okay, so here are three subunits. When the cell is not excited, these subunits are all attached to each other and they're bound to this receptor. Okay, when a regulatory molecule binds to the receptor right here, okay, then that activity is going to be transferred across the cell membrane and it's going to cause dissociation of these units, these three subunits. The beta and gamma typically like to stick together, but the beta and gamma then will dissociate from the alpha subunit. Right? The alpha subunit right here has been charged with an energy molecule, which is guanosine triphosphate. It's similar to ATP, but the base is just a little bit different. Instead of an adenine, there's a guanosine that binds to the alpha subunit. So you could consider this almost like an ATP molecule. So the alpha unit has been activated. Once the signaling molecule binds to the receptor, there's dissociation of the G protein. So here's the G protein, and we call this a G protein because it can bind GTP. That's the whole reason why. Otherwise, we would call it an A protein if it were to bind ATP. But in this particular case, it doesn't. ATP and GTP are very, very similar. All right, so the subunits break apart, and then they can separate from the receptor. All right, so we're going to forget about the receptor for right now. This beta and gamma subunit can float around on the interior surface of the membrane as well as this alpha subunit right here. And when it bumps into another protein inside the cell membrane, it can change the activity of this protein here. This is what we call an effector. All right, and this might be an ion channel that opens or closes, changing the electrical properties inside the cell. And if it's a sodium channel, that would excite the cell because sodium would rush in. Okay? Or this could be an enzyme. If beta and gamma bump into an enzyme, turning that enzyme on, that can then take ATP and convert it into cyclic AMP, then the second messenger builds up inside the cell. So the beta and gamma subunit can bind to an effector, or the alpha subunit can bind into similar classes of effectors. All right, and then after they bump into these effectors, they're released, they recombine at the receptor once again, and when they recombine, GTP is hydrolyzed into GDP. All right, and then this whole system gets re-energized when a GTP replaces the GDP on the alpha subunit right here, and this nice receptor G protein complex can now affect signal transduction across the cell membrane once again. Okay, so this is kind of a special kind of receptor protein that probably can't really say this is found in all forms of life, but I wouldn't be far wrong. Okay, most cells, right, which are the building block of life, have these G protein coupled receptors that can take information from the outside of the cell and bring it to the inside of the cell. All right, so this is an exam figure. So make sure you see everything on this figure, maybe draw it out a couple times, all right, so that you see what a G protein looks like. So here's the G protein, and here is the receptor. And what does the receptor bind? What does the receptor bind? The first messenger. Okay, and what does the G protein produce? It produces the second messenger inside the cell. Not really shown nicely on this diagram, but I did want to go over that. Okay, and what's the nature of this first messenger? What kind of properties does it have? It's hydrophilic, which means it likes to be in water, and because it likes to be in water, it cannot diffuse across the cell membrane. Okay. All right, so that's a nice signal transduction scheme. All right, so does anybody have any questions at all? Maybe you haven't studied enough to come up with questions yet. I'm not sure. Okay, but I do have office hours on Tuesday and Thursday next week. So you might want to come talk to me during those times if you have questions, like the online questions at the end of the chapter, or how to label those exam figures that are in your study guide. Okay, most students love the exam figures, because if you apply yourself to those exam figures, even if you have to draw them out, most students can get 100% on that part of the exam. So take advantage of that, because that will give you some breathing room on the other parts of the exam, like the multiple choice, which for most students typically is the tougher part of the exam. Not for everybody, but for some students it is that way. Okay, so don't forget, this equilibrium potential is due to two forces. One is the electrical attraction, and then the other is the concentration repulsion. And they balance each other out. So we call that the electrochemical gradient. And they can be in the same direction, or they can be in opposite directions, depending on the charge and the concentration gradient. Okay. All right, so let's see. Now we get to a chapter that I wanted to talk about earlier. Now's my chance. That's chapter 3. Cell structure and genetic control. We're going to look specifically at a cell membrane. We're going to consider that an organelle. It's got some special pieces. We'll look at all the other organelles inside the cell. We'll find out where the genetic material is located. So within the nucleus and chromosomes, and figure out what a gene is and what does it do. Okay, and I don't know if we're going to talk much about the cell cycle. That's mitosis, because we talked about that a lot in anatomy. All right, so here is a cell. And the cell is a basic unit of structure and function in the body. And so a cell has a cell membrane. It has genetic material, and it has cytoplasm. So it's got to have those three things. It's got to have a cell membrane or plasma membrane, cytoplasm, and what cytoplasm really means is that there's living junk inside this cell, okay? And it's got to have genetic material. And I don't see that on this slide, but it should have. If it doesn't have genetic material, it can't be a cell. And if it's not a cell, then it can't be alive, all right? So it's got to have those three things. So what about a virus? A virus has genetic material, but it doesn't have any cytoplasm. It might have a protein coat, but it doesn't have a cell membrane. So is a virus a living organism? No, it's not, because it's not a cell. It has genetic material, and then it has some proteins, and that's about it. Well, that's why viral infections are so difficult to treat, okay? Because if something's not alive, how can you kill it? You can't, right? So you can't take, like, an antibiotic. A bacteria is a cell because it has genetic material and it has cytoplasm. It's not sophisticated like this cell right here, but nonetheless, it has cytoplasm and genetic material and a cell membrane, so it is alive. So bacteria are relatively easy to kill because they are alive, as opposed to viruses. So if you have a bacterial infection, hopefully you can get your hands on a good antibiotic. If you have a viral infection, that's really difficult. You have to kind of beat a viral infection on your own. Your own immune system has to beat it for you. And if it's such a bad infection that your body doesn't have enough time to fight it, then that's really sad. Then people die as a result of that. That's why a flu virus is really dangerous for some people. Maybe not for our age group, but for the elderly or anybody that's immunocompromised, flu is a very deadly disease. So you should probably get a flu vaccine. And I think you can get them here for free in the health service. Are they available right now? Does anybody know if a flu vaccine is available right now for students? Yeah, it is. And is it free, or do you have to pay a couple bucks for it? I don't know. I forget. Usually it ends up being free sooner or later. And that's really helpful, maybe not for you, maybe not so helpful for me because I have a pretty good immune system, but if you have a grandma and grandpa at home, you have little kids at home, or anybody that is immunosuppressed at home, then you should get a flu vaccine because then you don't become a vector for bringing that flu virus into your family. So that's really helpful. So maybe you don't necessarily need it, but it could help other family members. Okay, so here we have a cell. Got the cell membrane, got the nucleus with genetic material, and we've got a bunch of organelles. I do want you to be able to identify these organelles by their shape and associate it with a name, like a Golgi complex right here, smooth endoplasmic reticulum, rough endoplasmic reticulum. Here's some more smooth endoplasmic reticulum right here. Mitochondria. So I want you to know the names of these things, but also be able to, when you look at the structure, tell me what its function is. Some bullet point information about their function. And we go over this in anatomy some, but we'll go over it again briefly in this class too. Let's start with the cell membrane. So here's the cell membrane, the basic building block, or the basic building, but I don't mean in terms of pH, but the essential unit of a cell membrane is a phospholipid, right? And so you have two layers, so we think of a cell membrane as a phospholipid bilayer. And we can see it right here, and you can see two layers. And a phospholipid bilayer is kind of like saran wrap. Hydrophilic molecules can't get across it, right? And it's very fluid as well. It's like a film of oil on top of water, maybe on your glass or a dish or bowl of soup or something. And if you jiggle that glass or that bowl of soup, what happens to that layer of oil that's right on the surface? Does it fracture and break? Okay, or it does what? It jiggles right along right on the surface of the water because that layer is very fluid as well. Okay, so that is one of the simplest natures of a cell membrane is that it is very fluid and it is oily, so it doesn't like to mix with water. Okay, and that's because of these phospholipids right here. So it restricts the passage of polar compounds, like water, for instance, or electrolytes, like sodium and potassium, can't get through the cell membrane. All right, well, the cell membrane is modified by inserting lipids and proteins and modified lipids and proteins into the cell membrane, which changes the shape of the membrane because it's changing what? The structure, right? So let's look and see what some of these things do. Here is a cholesterol molecule, and we can see cholesterol dissolve right up against these fatty acids right here of the these phospholipids, and these cholesterol molecules make the cell membrane a little bit more rigid, so it's not just like a layer of oil, which is kind of handy because when you stand up after lecture, you don't want all your cell membranes to drip down on the floor, right? You want your cell membranes to have a little bit of structure. Okay, there's other things that give structure to the membrane, and those are proteins. Here is a protein. This is an integral protein because it's inside the cell membrane. Here's another integral protein because it's inside the cell membrane. But this one right here also has a long extension to the inside of the cell. And this extension right here can be attached to microtubules and microfilaments inside the cell. And they can push and pull the cell membrane to give the cell a particular kind of shape. All right, so that is really handy. And then some cells are shapeshifters. Do you know what kind of cells you have in your body that can actually crawl around because they can change the shape of their cell membrane by what we call diapedesis? But there are white blood cells that fight infection, and they're crawling around between your cells inside your lung looking for bacteria and viruses all the time, right? Because they have microtubules and microfilaments that can push and pull on the cell membrane to change the shape of the cell. Okay, so some of these proteins can be modified by the addition of a carbohydrate. So here is a whole string of carbohydrates, and you can see that it has a certain branching pattern to it. And this branching pattern right here acts as a signpost that identifies the cell as belonging to a particular person. All right, so these are what we call antigens. The shape of this carbohydrate right here is going to change between you and one of your brothers or one of your sisters. Right? And it's going to change a little bit in shape, but as soon as you get to one of your cousins, the shape changes even more. And when you get to somebody that's not even related to you, the shape of this antigen is going to be a lot different, the branching pattern. And then when you get to a monkey or a worm or even a bacteria, then the shape is what? Radically different compared to you. So your immune system will recognize a cell inside your body as belonging to you or not based on the shape of this antigen. So cell membranes can have an antigen on what surface? The outside or inside surface? The outside surface, right. Okay. It can also have enzymes within the membrane, which can catalyze different kinds of biochemical reactions. And there can be receptors. We talked about receptor proteins within the membrane that, when stimulated, can change the physiology inside the cell. All right, so we got a number of different kinds of compounds that can be added to the phospholipid bilayer that change the function of the membrane. They could be ion channels, can be antigens, can be enzymes. And so there's a better way that we should think of a cell membrane, not as just a phospholipid bilayer, okay, but as a fluid mosaic model. Fluid because the phospholipid bilayer is very fluid, but it's also a mosaic because a lot of other compounds can be inserted into the membrane to change the function of the membrane. And if you have a cell, the apical surface of a cell might have a totally different function compared to the basal surface of a cell. And we'll have different kinds of transporters or enzyme systems in it. All right, so within the membrane, there can be transporters, enzymes, receptors, and identity markers. What did I just call an identity marker? An antigen. Yeah, an antigen. I think you should be familiar with that. Here, antigen. Okay, so carbohydrates can be modified into, they can have amino acids added to them. We'd call that a glycoprotein. Lipids can have sugars added to them. We call that a glycolipid. And that just increases the structural diversity of this membrane, which then changes the activity of this membrane. All right, so here is an example of a cell that's moving by diapedesis, and it sees a particle that it wants to absorb. Maybe this is a bacteria, maybe it's a food particle. And it's going to flow its cytoplasm around the particle, okay, and it's going to form a vesicle around this particle, and then the vesicle is going to break off and enter the cell. That's what we call phagocytosis, right? That's a form of active transport. So white blood cells can do this in our body, especially macrophages. A macrophage is a monocyte. That's a kind of white blood cell that's in our blood, but it can crawl out of our circulatory system and look for bacteria outside the circulatory system. When it does, then it becomes a macrophage. All right, and then I can maybe see some antigens on the cell surface of this bacteria, and the macrophage then can identify this antigen and develop a way to attack this cell based on the shape of the antigens that this bacterium has. Okay, and you have long-lasting immunity and short-lasting immunity, but that's beyond this class. You have to take a microbiology class to learn something about the different kinds of immunity. All right, so endocytosis is a process where things enter the cell, And it could be phagocytosis if it's a big particle, or pinocytosis if it is a fluid, if there are molecules in solution. Exocytosis is the reverse process, and that's done via secretory molecules. All right, so let me see if I have a picture of exocytosis, sort of. Okay, let's look at the cell right here. So here we have endoplasmic reticulum, and if I look at the surface, I see that it's very rough. So this is what we call rough endoplasmic reticulum. Here is a kind of endoplasmic reticulum that is missing these ribosomes, so it looks like it has a smooth surface. Right? We call this smooth endoplasmic reticulum. The rough ER, because it has ribosomes, it can synthesize proteins. So the workbench where proteins are made inside the cell is within a ribosome. So since rough ER has ribosomes, its function is protein synthesis. Okay, and then those proteins are trapped inside this membrane, inside the rough endoplasmic reticulum. Sometimes the rough endoplasmic reticulum then forms a vesicle, and inside that vesicle will be the proteins that it made. And that vesicle then hops on, gets a ride from a microtubule or a microfilament that takes the vesicle over to the Golgi complex or Golgi apparatus. The vesicle then fuses to the Golgi apparatus. The job of the Golgi apparatus is to take that protein and modify it. It might add a sugar molecule to it, making it a glycoprotein, or maybe adding a lipid to it. Okay, so now you have a modified protein within the membrane of the Golgi apparatus, and the Golgi apparatus changes its shape. It forms a vesicle right here, and that vesicle moves away from the Golgi apparatus to the cell membrane. And let's go over here. So here we have a vesicle fusing to the cell membrane, and when it fuses to the cell membrane, the interior contents of that vesicle then gets exocytosed into the extracellular space. So this is an example of a secretory process where some protein is made by rough ER, moves into the Golgi apparatus for modification, and then that modified protein gets exported through that secretory vesicle to outside the cell. So that's a nice secretory pathway for proteins or modified proteins. So the function of a ribosome is protein synthesis. And that means then the function of rough endoplasmic reticulum is protein synthesis because it has ribosomes. What about the smooth ER right here? What's the function of smooth ER? Can it be protein synthesis? It cannot be because it doesn't have a ribosome. But I'll tell you what its function is. Its function is to make lipids. Okay, so lipid synthesis, but also some cells take calcium from the cytoplasm and pump it into the smooth endoplasmic reticulum. So I have very low calcium inside the cell, high calcium within the smooth endoplasmic reticulum, so the inside of the cell looks like it has almost zero calcium ions. All right, so that's the second function for smooth ER. It's for synthesizing lipids or for storing calcium. All right, what's another place in your body that stores calcium for you? Bones, yeah, because that's a reservoir for calcium, okay? The smooth ER in some tissues is even more important for storing calcium than your bones. All right, so there's that secretory pathway. What are some other organelles? I see some microtubules right here. Microtubules are a way for the cell, because they can push and pull on integral proteins. Other kinds of organelles, like a vesicle right here, can hop a ride on a microtubule or microfilament to a different part of the cell. When a cell is undergoing mitosis, where chromosomes are being separated or moved around inside the cell, and even the cell membrane is deformed, forming that cleavage furrow during telophase, during cytokinesis. So these microfilaments and tubules can shape a cell, but they can also move things around inside the cell. So it's like a railway system, right? But a microtubule is just a single rail. It's not a double rail like you think of a train. But there are trains that just have one rail. What are those called? Monorails, right? So this microtubule system inside the cell is really like a monorail system running around in the cell over here. And there are motor proteins that can attach to it to move things around one way or the other. And what controls the monorail system are the centrioles, these barrel-shaped structures. Usually they're kind of oriented perpendicular to each other. But this is the origin of the microtubule system, and it controls the microtubules and microfilaments. That helps determine where organelles are going to move around, what the shape of the cell is, and if the cell is actually, if it can change shape, is controlled by these centrioles. So centrioles are real important for mitosis, for instance, when chromosomes are being manipulated. Okay, here is a bean-shaped structure. And I see that this bean-shaped structure right here has an outside membrane and an inner membrane. Most of the organelles that we've looked at so far only have one membrane layer. Right? The nucleus has two membranes around it, but that's going to be different than the mitochondria. Then we have some organelles like the centriole right here that doesn't have a membrane around it at all. The ones that have a membrane around it are what we call membrane-bound organelles. The ones that don't have a membrane around them, well, we don't call them membrane-bound because they're not bound up by a membrane. But the mitochondria is pretty special. It's a membrane-bound organelle, but there are two layers. The inside layer right here is what we call the Christi membrane. So they're two different compartments. And the job of the mitochondria, we're going to be really involved in the mitochondria pretty soon, is to make energy for the cell in the form of ATP, adenosine triphosphate. So mitochondria can take oxygen and it can take nutrient molecules like glucose, and it can take a low-energy molecule like ADP and convert it into ATP, as long as it has an energy source and oxygen. So this is the organelle inside your body that requires oxygen to make ATP for us. And that's the reason why we do what? Inhale, that's right. And then the mitochondria take that oxygen, right, and make ATP for us, and then the excretory product is CO2. And then what do? That's why we exhale, to get rid of CO2, right? And in the meantime, these mitochondria are making ATP for us. So, mitochondria make ATP. And Rough ER makes proteins. Smooth ER makes lipids, but also stores calcium. These microfilaments and microtubules are important for motility, maybe give the cell shape. Centrioles control the microtubules. We have some other membrane-bound organelles inside the cell. Here's a lysosome. There is also something called a peroxisome. Maybe it's not labeled on this diagram. And something called an endosome. All right, a lysosome right here contains a compound called lysozyme. Lysozyme is an enzyme that can break macromolecules down into their building blocks. And you know what some of these building blocks are now. What's the building block of a protein? Amino acids, right? So a lysosome can break down a protein down into amino acids. Or it can break a triglyceride down into fatty acids and glycerol, right? Or it can break down a segment of DNA into nucleotides. So it hydrolyzes, right? So because it has a lysozyme. So a lysosome is an intracellular digestive system. So it can digest things that are inside the cell down into its basic building blocks, and then when you have those basic building blocks, the cell can build the kinds of compounds that it wants. All right. Another kind of vesicle inside the cell is what we call a peroxisome, and a peroxisome has peroxidase. The key term for what that does is that it detoxifies chemicals, so it can take a toxic chemical and detoxify it for us. All right, so a peroxisome is for detoxification. A lysosome is for digestion. So those are good key terms. And an endosome, we talked about an endosome because it's important for routing. It can sequester cell membrane components and a membrane inside the cell, right, deactivating the cell membrane, or it can take those cell membrane components and insert it into the membrane, thereby activating the membrane. And some of those little components we talked about was a transporter for glucose in particular. Okay, and an endosome that has a glucose transporter inside the cell will wait for an insulin signal to put the glucose transporter in the cell membrane so that glucose can enter the cell. So you got different kinds of vesicles for different purposes, sometimes for digestion, sometimes for detoxification, sometimes for activating the cell membrane, turning it into a different kind of structure. All right, so I'm not sure where we got to here. All right, but we're going to continue this next week. We got two lectures on the rest of the cell. Read through these notes right here. Maybe the most complicated one is gene expression. I'll finish up organelles and get into gene expression next time. Thanks.